Yes, my family thanked you, Sue, for sure.
Yeah, I bet.
So I'm John. I actually like eating chocolate. Giselle, I do like eating chocolate. So I'm going to walk you through, hopefully in a few minutes, three topics that relate to survivorship, and I think that are probably going to be relevant to everybody. Firstly, the question of recurrence, how that may show up, what to look out for, maybe a little bit about why we may do or do things that you may want us to do. Some things about late effects, complications of treatment, so again, things we may recommend to watch out for or to monitor. And as this was a very hot button topic for us, often vaccinations, what to do. So the Canadian philosophy about monitoring is not to do very much in the way of regular imaging. But what you'll see is this practice varies a lot from practitioner to practitioner, okay? And the way things work in Ontario anyways, you can do whatever you want. You know, if you want to book a scan for somebody once every 2 months, once every 3 months, once every 6 months, the system has no rules, unlike about chemotherapy, as to what you can do. Okay, so you can do tests as often as you want. You may eventually get a call from a radiologist that would say, why are you ordering so many scans in people? But if you want, you can. What I'll say is that the data that are published say that relapses generally are not picked up by routine CT scans. Okay, and when we do them in clinical trials, you do have a situation where you can do a CT scan and 2 weeks later, which is fine, and 2 weeks later, someone comes in with symptoms that ultimately is recurrent disease. So one of the things I explain to my patients is that you may take a great sense of security about a CT scan, but you have to remember it's a snapshot and it's one moment in time that may say you have disease or not. And the problem with cancer in general is that it's a microscopic disease, right? So you need one bad cell floating around that's going to start growing. We don't have tests that can detect one cell at any one time. As we talked about in the panel, I guess, before, there is very little blood work that we tend to do routinely when we see people in well follow-up, because there is no test that we can use to diagnose the recurrence of lymphoma. People sometimes think that we're looking for the disease itself when we're doing blood tests, but often in people who have chemotherapy or have had chemotherapy previously, you need to watch to see that blood counts are normal, because drops in blood counts may reflect consequences of previous chemotherapy that we need to watch out for. In the worst case scenario is the development of a leukemia in someone who's received previous chemotherapy. Relapse typically is often identified by the patient, okay? Because patients have a very high index of suspicion and have lived through the diagnosis of a cancer before. And so you know what to watch out for in a way, even though everyone likes to ask us what to watch out for. But you know, because you know what you've been through. Though there's often that concern of, I didn't have a symptom, and somehow I got to medical attention, okay? But most of the time, relapse is identified by someone coming in and saying, I don't feel well, or I noticed a lump, or I have new pain, I don't have an explanation for it, and then that triggers subsequent investigation. And so, what to watch out for? Well, what did the lymphoma do originally? And some of that may be obvious. We tend to dwell on constitutional symptoms, so the fever, sweats, weight loss, but I would say typically those are things that don't tend to happen that often. Okay, and why is that? So the reason those symptoms may develop is that lymphomas may be growing very quickly, and so they use and give off a lot of energy, and those are all symptoms of energy. And at the same time, if there's a lot of disease around, that's also a way that you can see those symptoms present. But typically these may be painless lumps, like lymphadenopathy and large lymph nodes, or things that are unusual for you, and those are the things that we really want to hear about. So how often does this happen? Well, you've seen all of that information from the various speakers today, that recurrence varies with the disease that you've been treated for and the time from prior therapy. And in the diseases that are typically curable, the further out that you get from the time your treatment completed, the more likely you are to be cured. What we usually discuss is the first year is the highest period of risk for a disease to come back. You remember most of those curves when we showed you survival curves look like hockey sticks, so we're all Canadian, right? So the first year or two is where most people tend to have their recurrences, and those become far less common at 3 or 4 or 5 years. And as I said before, when you get to that fifth year, that's when we generally say that the pattern of recurrence is such that the likelihood of recurrence is very low. In certain scenarios, recurrences can be curable. Also in certain circumstances, people can do very well whether it's cure or not. But it's very difficult to generalize this to a variety of patients, a whole variety of scenarios, and that's why the details at the time of recurrence will definitely influence what can be done and potentially what the goals of treatment may be. So that's the bit about recurrence. Moving on to this issue of late effects, so this is something that comes up in the setting of people that you think are very likely to be cured or are essentially cured, because these are things that we see more than 3 to 4 to 5 years after treatment. And there are a variety of things you can see, but I'm going to focus on a couple of the more common ones, mainly secondary cancers, cardiac disease, and issues related to fertility. So why do these things happen? Why do people develop secondary cancers? There's probably a couple of reasons, but the one that we think is likely the most important is, as I mentioned before, chemotherapy works, as does radiation, by damaging DNA in normal cells as well as in malignant cells. Now, the bystander effect of affecting normal cells is not something we're looking for, but when you introduce injury into the genome, that sets things up for subsequent hits, and we like to believe that this is probably a multi-step process that then leads to the development of another abnormal group of cells that is ultimately malignant. The difficulty here, though, is what you know about the epidemiology of cancer in 2012 with an aging population is that even if you haven't had cancer before, cancer is pretty common. Right, so the risk of breast cancer in a woman over their lifetime is 1 in 9. The risk of prostate cancer, I think if you're a guy and you live long enough, you're probably going to get prostate cancer. And you know, when Sue said that the risk of lymphoma in a Canadian, it's 1 in 30 over lifetime, not 1 in 300 per year, it's 1 in 300 per lifetime probably. But you get a sense that these are common things, yet the point here is that if you've been exposed to these types of drugs, that risk is higher. Okay, but it can be difficult to sort some of those issues out. So this is a slide I stole from Michael that looks at Hodgkin's lymphoma. And so we're going to focus a lot here on Hodgkin's lymphoma as a model for a specific reason. And that's because, again, the cure rate in Hodgkin's lymphoma has been high enough for long enough that there are lots of survivors. And because they're younger people, they've been followed for a long time, and you have time to understand what happens to people after they complete therapy. One of the good news points about the treatment of aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or follicular lymphoma is that the cure rates, and if not the cure rates, the time that people can be alive with their disease, we've improved survival in all of those diseases over time. The consequences of that is that we may learn that some of these other complications that were less common when people were dying from disease may happen moving forward. But I think we can apply the lessons that we've learned from Hodgkin's lymphoma equally in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So the point here is that there's an inflection point where the cause of death from Hodgkin's disease reaches its max, and that causes of death due to other issues that aren't Hodgkin's disease become more dominant, okay? And that's where you see the fallout, not from the disease, but potentially from the treatment. And so in people who survive, second cancers are probably the biggest problem in Hodgkin's lymphoma, and typically these are solid tumors that you tend to see at more than 5 years out. And the principle, as I'll show you shortly, is that if we can minimize the amount of treatment and preserve the cure rate, we believe that these secondary cancers, the incidence should come down. But we've learned that over time, particularly from an era where giving very high-dose radiation early on was largely the standard of care before chemotherapy got better. And similarly, we used to give a lot of very intensive chemotherapy before we realized that that wasn't necessary. And so we've been able to dial back the treatment get to where we are today. And, you know, much like those issues of epidemiology that we were referring to, there now is a host of work being performed at looking at modifying these late effects, either through screening or prevention. And again, I'll give you some examples of that moving forward. So In this cohort of over 32,000 patients who survived Hodgkin's lymphoma, those rates refer to the relative risk, so the proportion over what you would see in the general population. So for breast cancer, it's 2 times the risk. For lung, it's almost 3. And you can see for at the bottom there, leukemia at almost 10 times the risk. Admittedly, this needs to be taken very cautiously because these are survivors of treatment that was the way it was given 10 or 20 years before this. Okay, so that would have been treatment from the 80s and 90s. And as I've shown you, with what we've done with treatment today, these risks are very likely to be overestimates now that we have more precise and minimal treatment, at least in this disease. And what you can see here, so this is, again, work from a European group that shows that potentially by giving less radiation, and that's the blue curve as an example, where they were able to withdraw some of the radiation, they could see a reduction in the risk in the relative risk for breast cancer by almost 2/3. So making proof that if you pull away on the therapy, you can reduce the risk of secondary cancers. And this is specifically with breast risk. The other thing here that we didn't perhaps understand as much 10 or 20 years ago was that there may be consequences to the heart as well, and then maybe it makes sense when you're giving radiation that can affect the heart, as Dr. Tsang had shown, but again, the techniques there are getting safer, they're more likely to preserve or minimize treatments this way, and as well, the drugs that we use, so the A and ABVD potentially contributes to this as well, but when you can see those risks become lower over time if you're able to pull away on the amount of radiation you give or if you don't give radiation at all. And this is where it becomes critical that we need to balance the trade-offs here in terms of what we can do with cure and balance against late effects. But again, another example of minimizing treatment can lead to improvement. And so this is a slide that one of our colleagues, David Hodgson, put together that illustrates the principles. So the column on the left there shows lower doses and smaller fields of radiation. And again, our belief is that over time, we'll see less second cancers, particularly less breast cancer. And the jury's still out because we don't have a lot of data about the cardiac effects yet, but we believe that things should be better there as well. And again, the other issue here is that the cardiac care has gotten a lot better. The cardiologists are much better at looking after people. The drugs are better. The other support is better. And so I think we have other opportunities, even if we see more risk in our patients, to prophylax. And those relationships with our cardiology colleagues will be very important. And what do we recommend? So in people that we would be labeled as being at high risk for developing breast cancer after Hodgkin's lymphoma. So these are people, women up to the age of 30, who would have received radiation to the chest. We actually recommend an aggressive screening policy to start 8 years after, 7 to 8 years after radiation therapy, using a combination of mammography, which would be standard potentially for the general population, but in combination with MRI. Because there is data from people, including from our center in a study led by Mike, I think, that looked at MRI and show that in a high-risk group of people, it's actually a better screening tool, okay? What we don't know yet is doing other things like stealing from the breast cancer doctors about hormone prevention, things like tamoxifen, etc., if we may be able to reduce this risk as well with drugs. And that's something we would actually have to do in a clinical trial and prove that it's effective, okay? But there is screening here we believe very strongly in a high-risk population, because in a solid tumor, if you're able to intervene early when the disease is localized, generally that means a better cure rate. The issue of fertility remains a very difficult one. I think we don't have very good ways to evaluate it, again, as far as blood tests. Again, the men have the easy way out here, as you can see, because we have a great way to deal with the problem with banking sperm. One of the points here, again, unfortunately, there isn't a lot of data in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma about this. So we often rely on the data from Hodgkin's lymphoma, but the point here is with ABVD, the likelihood of actually running into problems with sperm counts or function or what have you is actually quite low. It's probably at most in the range of 10%, whereas with the more aggressive type treatments, it might be as high as 90%. The difficulty With women as well, again, is there the strategies you can use to preserve fertility are far less proven, often take more time if you need to harvest eggs through ovarian stimulation. It's expensive as well. But as you can see there, if you look at a surrogate, which is amenorrhea, so losing periods and not having them recover, that is not very common with ABVD. But unfortunately, having your periods come back, if you're a young woman, doesn't necessarily predict very well with fertility ultimately. I think the other point that's important in context here is if you look at what's happening in society in general, we're more likely to be having kids at an older age. And you know, that may be one of the contributors that, you know, what's out there in the literature these days is about 1 in 9 couples, perfectly healthy, can't conceive. Okay, so again, over time, it'll be a little more difficult, but still important to understand what the increase in risk with fertility may be with the application of chemotherapy again, because I'd say, you know, particularly with examples like Giselle, when we've put people through treatment and we have a high expectation now with cure rates getting better of having people live and return to normal life, we want that to be as normal as possible. This is a study, again, that came out of our group, that in patients receiving ABVD, so the control patients are people who are age-matched and otherwise perfectly healthy, and the darker curve are the patients with a prior history of Hodgkin's lymphoma. This shows that if you want to try to get pregnant, at least in this data set, we couldn't show a difference between the people who'd received ABVD or were perfectly healthy in terms of the ability to conceive. Okay, so there isn't a lot of data like this out there yet. Hasn't been replicated in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. We need investigators that are interested in doing this sort of thing. But at least there are principles here that this isn't a sentence to say that we're going to have to give up regular conception as an option in patients who have completed treatment. So the alternatives for the time being, I'd say with males it's easy, sperm banking is the right thing to do. It's something you can do very quickly even if you need to treat people 24 or 48 hours later. The issue, so we had a fertility expert come to this meeting we ran yesterday, and unfortunately there aren't very good data looking at alternatives for women yet. Hopefully the fertility experts will continue to do this because there clearly is an area of need. But unfortunately I don't have a lot more to tell you at this time. And, you know, the summary then, I showed you a lot of data from Hodgkin's lymphoma, but I think the idea here is that's a great model that we can learn from for all these other diseases. Again, follicular lymphoma is now much more a chronic disease where even with your first treatment, it's very likely you're going to be in remission for 4 to 5 to 6 years, and we continue to improve the arsenal of drugs that are available. Radiation is an excellent strategy. So even in the incurable disease, we can expect that we're going to have people live for a very, very long time. And as we alter treatments, as we find non-toxic, more targeted treatments, and use radiation judiciously and selectively and very elegantly targeted, we're going to minimize toxicity for patients, which is excellent. It is important, though, to have a game plan in terms of an approach to screening and what to look for. And this is where I always emphasize the idea of being plugged in with your family doctor as much as being plugged in with the specialist center that's looking after you, because all those details about regular prostate screening for men, regular mammography or whatever you need for women, colon cancer screening for all of us, those are things that need to be done. Ideally, they need to be done in a place that's close to home so that if you need to have follow-up on those tests, it can be looked after. And when you're well and seeing the cancer specialist once a year, or when you get kicked out, if you're cured at some point, someone else needs to continue to follow through on those things. So I'm going to switch to vaccines, and I have to thank again another colleague, Jay Keystone, who's an infectious disease specialist that provided me a couple of these slides because I didn't have anything up to date here. And so from a principal standpoint, again, we talked a bit about vaccination anyway, but lymphoma, because it is a disease of the immune system, even in the absence of treatment for it, increases the risk of infection. Okay, so the immunity is no longer normal. The issue with vaccines then is that the vaccine and its effect can be affected, and the effect can be affected by the fact that lymphoma has impaired the normal immune system, chemotherapy may suppress the immune system, and these, and potentially after stem cell transplants, again, a completely different set of rules too. But the principle here is that we don't expect vaccines to work as well because they require the immune system to do their job. Okay, and so because of that, the immune response may be decreased. The likelihood of mounting a long response to a vaccine over time is likely to be lower, and we have to be very cautious with live vaccines, okay? Because live vaccines, if you don't have the effectors, if you don't have the soldiers to fight the virus in the vaccine, you can potentially get sick from the vaccine. And that isn't just the, you know, the pain in the arm and the feeling crappy for a day or two after flu vaccine that we all get when we get vaccinated at the hospital. So the key vaccines I think we need to be aware of are tetanus, diphtheria, again highlighted in red, seasonal influenza vaccine, and again pneumococcal vaccine, because often some of the things hematologists do to people make the spleen and its function less effective. Sometimes we take spleens out, but that also puts you at risk, particularly for pneumococcus. Again, one of the most common kinds of pneumonia. It's a pretty bad bug, even though we have great antibiotics to deal with it, but it can lead to overwhelming infection. You'll see the two there, varicella, so that's chickenpox, and MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella, are live vaccines, and again, potentially might have risks associated with them. So these are, again, the other list of things that may be considered important. Herpes zoster, we talked about in the panel session earlier, but these are things, again, that you can think of in terms of vaccination strategy. So the principles here, if you have time before treatment's given, it should be, ideally try to vaccinate before treatment starts, because again, your immunity is as good as it will be for the next little while. And so the rule there is nothing live, nothing active, so use inactivated viruses. Again, Jay's comments here would be vaccines given during chemotherapy, let the therapy and its consequences fall away, and then readminister treatment after 3 months. This becomes a little more complicated in the setting where you're using rituximab, okay? Because rituximab, one of the great principles of it as an anti-cancer drug is that it hangs around in the bloodstream for ages. It may be there for 3 to 6 months. As a way to depress immunity, that isn't a great thing because it's around for a while, and the effect in terms of recovery of immune function takes longer than what we think will be the case with traditional chemotherapy. So Jay said something a little provocative here. Live vaccines can be given 3 months post-chemo if in remission, except in the setting of transplant. So there continues to be safety issues about that, like I told you about Zostavax. So I think most of us are going to be fairly conservative there, given the potential risks we may be exposing someone to. But I think that's a question you can have in the clinic with your treating physician at the time and see. And our practice, certainly after any type of stem cell transplant, is we will have wiped out all of the immunity that one would have received from childhood vaccination, and we routinely recommend all of those vaccines be given again. Again, conservatively, we know a lot of immunity recovers at 1 year after a transplant procedure, and there is some data that suggests it can be probably given earlier. And so, again, if there's anyone out there in the audience with that's actually had a stem cell transplant, these are potential recommendations. You'll see Jay has highlighted in red the ones that are controversial. Again, those are actually contraindicated by the Centers for Disease Control in the U.S., and I think we will be conservative, though these are now in clinical trials, particularly Zostavax, Varicellavax as well, to kind of see if these things are going to be safe or not. So we will have answers. It will just take a little time. And again, similar principle with stem cell transplant as far as chemotherapy, pneumovax, influenza, meningococcal vaccines, all potentially bad diseases, all potentially preventable. But remember, in some of these cases, you do need boosters in terms of these vaccines, in terms of having adequate protection. And as I'd mentioned before, one of the concerns in this setting is if you actually look to see if the vaccine does its job, there are a few papers that are out there in the literature that have looked at this question. Unfortunately, the vaccine response in people who've received chemotherapy is lower than normal. If you received rituximab, it's likely lower than that. And if you've had a transplant, depending on time, it will be even lower than that. And so it's cautious. But in the scenario where you can give the vaccine safely with no risk, you give it. If you're potentially giving a vaccine where there is a risk with the vaccine, i.e. a live vaccine, that's where it becomes more dicey. And so these are, again, common vaccines you can get through your family physician. I'd say probably the two most important ones are that combined tetanus diphtheria one. Again, as a regular adult, you're supposed to get tetanus revaccinated every 10 years. So if you ever walk into the Emerge and you've cut yourself out in the shed or something, they're going to give you another tetanus shot. But it equally applies for patients who've had chemotherapy. And now that there are these newer pneumococcal vaccines later that are now available, those schedules should be followed as well. So that was a very, very quick tour. So the principle here in survivorship, again, is I think in large part a success story, because people who may not have been expected to get old get a chance to get old. And along the way, there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of what happens. But hopefully, if we no longer have to deal with the consequences of the disease, that's probably the thing that we can be the most happy about. But then the next step is to try and deal with the consequences of the therapy. And again, the lesson from Hodgkin's lymphoma is that can be done successfully. And our goal as people who look after patients with lymphoma is to try and do that in all the other kinds of lymphoma, because now people live much longer. Remember, though, things that happen to people with cancer don't always happen because of the treatment or the disease that itself, and that some caution and rationale should be looked at in all these things. I can't overestimate the importance of primary care physicians and the role that they need to play. But this, again, is an area that we and advocacy groups need to be able to provide guidance, because some of this data changes a lot. And, you know, even for someone who is specialized and treats essentially nothing but lymphoma, vaccination is not specifically something I know a lot about, and that's why I have colleagues that do this stuff. And maintaining contact with expert centers, as we try to do in Ontario and network together a lot, is probably the goal. And I think with that, that's all I have to say. And if you want, it is getting late in the day, but I'll take a question or two if you want. So thanks.